the musical icon that was David Bowie.
David Bowie.
Berlin was probably the most rewarding for me as an artist in my life.
How his move to the city in the 1970s both saved and rejuvenated him.
He was in the mood to do something fresh, something new.
It was literally like being reborn.
I'm Francis Whateley, and I knew David for almost 20 years. For Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, I'll be revealing what really happened during this mythologised period of his life.
This was in some ways a proposal.
Yes, I didn't know quite how to respond.
Bowie in Berlin, this Saturday night at 8.
Back to This Evening on Radio 4, where we join Victoria Corin-Mitchell for Heresy. In this episode, which originally aired in 2022, the panel discuss feelings and trigger warnings.
Hello and welcome to a brand new series of Heresy, the show that's been fighting against received wisdom since 2003, with only the occasional three-year break, such as when a divisive political leader complains about a joke, the Prime Minister says she agrees, and it triggers a police investigation. But that's almost never. This is the space where free speech and free thinking are welcome, where we will not be cowed by wokery and cancel culture. In this fearless corner of the BBC, I'm completely at liberty to say, for example, that Jeremy Corbyn... with a hardback copy of Jews Don't Count by David Baddiel. And speaking of which, joining me tonight are old grandfather heresy himself, David Baddiel, the comedian Desiree Birch, and the artist Grayson Perry. Grayson, this isn't the easiest climate for playing the heresy game. How's cancel culture going for you?
It's an opportunity for all those people who know best to really exercise themselves. It doesn't really matter what they opine about. It's just that they love knowing best. And they're usually men.
Desiree, do you worry that every joke will be your last?
The thing is, the stuff that I would assume is risky, you're like, bring them on! But there are bits that I've done that I'm just like, this is just true, and people go, oh! You know, a friend said a thing about people of color not doing a lot of extreme sports, and I was like, yeah, because we don't need to pay for elaborate ways to die. You know, like, white people have to, like, snowboard out of a helicopter, all we have to do is go buy Skittles in Florida. You know, or do anything in Florida. And thank you for laughing at that. When I do it in the show, people go, oh! And I'm like, I didn't kill them all. What's wrong with you? Like, it's not too soon, it's too late. That's the problem.
David, you had the pleasure of launching Heresy in 2003. Was it easier then?
When I was doing the show, there wasn't much social media, so you didn't have the thing now where you can edit a tiny bit of the show and put it out there without the context. But my first real experience of, like, I've been cancelled from lots of different quarters, somehow still here. But I was on Jonathan Ross's talk show in about 2013, and I said that my 10-year-old son had done this joke. We were watching telly, and that advert came on, Red Bull gives you wings, and he said, and diabetes. And I got hundreds of outraged people telling me that my son needed to educate himself about that disease and how it works. And then I realised that what these people were actually saying is that what my 10-year-old son should have said is Red Bull gives you wings and type 2 diabetes.
See what I mean? As people who know best.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, in a spirit of slight trepidation, I say, let's give heresy a go. As always, we'll be arguing against three statements of widely held belief and seeing what we can come up with to challenge those wisdoms. First, we're going to talk about our feelings.
You might laugh today. You might cry today. You might feel many different feelings. And they're all okay.
Well, what a lovely American voice.
Waiting for that.
80% of our live audience here in the theatre tonight believe the British are more reserved than their American counterparts. Desiree, you're American. What are they not seeing?
Ah, my goodness. This could not be further from the truth. You are answering with your sober minds when your lives are never, ever sober. There is nothing reserved about British people, all right? Because most Americans, when we get drunk, we have the decency to vomit and go home. Not you guys. You're like zombie apocalypse reanimated corpses running around. Oh, we should be best mates. Oh, you're my best friend. Nobody's ever understood me like you do. You guys are not reserved. It's just that the next day when you sober up, you feel the requisite amount of shame for all the things that you did the night before, which is appropriate, all right?
Grayson, you're not American. Do you think the old cliche is still true, that the Brits are a reserved, repressed nation?
Well, people always say that, like, people up north are friendlier, don't they? But it's really that they're more open. They're very, very open about the more, perhaps the more negative things, whereas in America, there's that sort of superficial, what they call positive politeness. They're more reserved about sort of like slagging you off, whereas in Britain, I think it's the other way around. We're a bit embarrassed of being positive. Like when I was doing my series about taste, everybody, when I said, you know, what is good taste, people would tell me what bad taste was. And the shotguns are lining up for you. The minute you say you like something, it's like, poof, poof, you know.
Well, I would say, as a Brit, that, you know, everything about life is so terrible that positivity is itself a sign of repression. You know, they have to... David, you're a dual citizen, British and American. What do you think?
I've done shows that don't suggest, because I do think of myself as British, that I'm from a repressed background, about my dad's dementia and about my mum having a long-term affair with a golfing memorabilia salesman. my mum did do that, and she was incredibly open about it in terms of this repression. Like, for example, when she first met my brother's girlfriend, she'd never met her before, and she was talking to my brother, and this guy's name came up, and she turned to the girlfriend and just went, "My lover of 20 years," and carried on talking to my brother. As if nothing had happened, right? And, like, and my dad was another type, because my dad, some of you may know, he had a disease called Pick's disease, a type of frontal lobe dementia. And the neurologist, I remember telling me the symptoms, irritability, mood swings, swearing, apathy, extreme disinhibition. And I said, sorry, has he got a disease? Have you just met him? Because I think the idea that we're repressed is wrong. What we are, British people, are realistic. I don't think so. I think they are coy as well. They're coy. Like calling a toilet a washroom. I mean, I do a bit of washing in there, but a lot more toileting, I'll be honest with you.
In the 17th century, America was colonised by austere Puritans, and yet these days, America is responsible for most of the hardcore pornography that's on my phone. Yes. But it still lingers on, doesn't it? The religious right has big power in America, and they're quite repressed, but they drive the political agenda.
Why is it on your phone?
You never know when the urge is going
to
arise.
Yeah, that's true.
You don't want to be underground and be like, now's the moment.
Can you not watch you during the show, Victoria? That's all I ask.
This question does slightly remind me of one of my favourite ever Twitter exchanges, which was a guy, there was something going on, and this American guy was slightly racist. And the English guy said, listen to yourself, mate. And the American guy said, oh, I do love you, English people. He said, even when you're criticising what we're saying, you're polite, you called me mate. And the other guy goes, well, in Britain, mate has many meanings, one of which is...
And also, oddly enough, in parts of Britain... means a really good mate, which is so confusing.
You're listening to Radio 4.
Oh, that three-year hiatus. It's really taught the programme something, hasn't it?
Grace, famously, you've been very expressive with your clothing choices.
I wear my kind of issues on my sleeve, literally, in some ways, yeah.
Do you think the coexistence of you and Claire, your alter ego, is a sign of British expressiveness or oppression?
No, it's because I'm a pervert. It has no kind of sophisticated cultural context, no. I just get off on it.
I think they admire it if you say that's what it is. We respond to frankness. I mean, in this program's old friend Nigel Farage.
Mm. Mate, he's a real mate.
He's a real mate. Isn't he? I think we should open this up to the audience. Joe May from Brighton. You agreed that the British are more reserved than their American counterparts. What's your evidence?
It comes from a really weird place, actually. I'm technically a puppeteer. I've worked with a few American puppeteers, and this is going to sound nuts, but the way they channel their energy through a puppet, you can even see it in, let's take Warhorse versus the Muppets. It's a different energy.
I like the sound of that as a fight.
No, but I want to hear, this is fascinating. What do you mean?
Well, I think we're still reserved even when we channel through our performance.
What are you seeing as the difference between Warhorse and the Muppets? Well,
I mean, don't get me wrong, they're different styles of show, right? They're different styles of performance. But I do think Americans kind of sometimes make better puppeteers. Because they're less... Even I find myself being, like, self-conscious about even saying I'm a puppeteer.
Thank you very much for overcoming your British reserve to join in. I hope we've persuaded you to think again about your transatlantic assumptions in either direction. Although, can I just say, I am quite reserved. You know those couples you see arguing on a night out, yelling at the tops of their voices, pointing and jeering? I save that for the bedroom. In all honesty, during romantic encounters, I do actually like to vocalise really explicit things about my husband's body. But unfortunately, my Pilates coach really hates that. Next, we're going to talk about what David Beckham's been up to. This year's World Cup in Qatar is already being hailed as a global celebration of football. I say football, I mean oil. But I won't say anything worse than that because I'm influenced by Qatar's new brand ambassador, David Beckham. How did they persuade him to do that? Ask yourself this question, do you want to be rich? I've got the brains, you've got the looks. Let's make lots of money. You've got the brawn, I've got the brain. Let's make lots of money. Money. 82% of our live audience believe David Beckham should not have taken £10 million to promote the nation of Qatar. Grayson, what do you think?
Well, he's got his son's wedding coming up. Yeah, I mean, one thing I would say about Qatar from my personal viewpoint, which makes them very attractive, is they're the biggest buyer of art by value any country in the world, apparently.
Why do you think that is?
I think they just buy things that have got a really big price tag because they've just got so much money. You know, I don't think they've been particularly good.
Is there someone in Qatar with your pots?
No, I don't think so. I don't think my pots would go down particularly well. And also, David Beckham, he's got a brand of whiskey that he's trying to flog. Perhaps, you know, he's seeing that as a kind of unexploited market. Maybe David, though, he's getting on a bit, isn't he? I think he's like 46 now. Things are starting to droop and he doesn't look so good with a knobbly watch anymore. So he's got a look. You know those watches with all the buttons on. It's basically masculinity in a single artifact.
Desiree, I don't know, as an American, if you're familiar with David Beckham. Think of him as like the thinking man's Joe Pasquale.
Honestly, I don't know why people are so opposed to this, especially in this country. Posh and Beckham are probably worth $500 million together, right? They're Britain's best hope for buying any of the property back that Qatar has bought from Britain.
I have a soft spot for David Beckham because, as everyone knows, he is Jewish. I've met him a few times and he's told me that he's basically not religious, but if he was to identify as anything, it would be a Jew. Having said that, I'm not sure bringing that up while we're talking about him taking millions from an unscrupulous political regime is helpful to my other work, dismantling anti-Semitic stereotypes. A serious opinion. What is that actually about? It's because of this notion that footballers are role models. Are they? Should they be? I mean, I'm of a certain generation, but the footballers I think of as when I was growing up were like George Best, Maradona, Vinnie Jones, if these people were role modelling, who grew up following their example? Like, Voldemort? Really? I mean, they're sports people, right? Greg Norman, the golfer, once said, "I owe a lot to my parents, especially my mother and father." David Beckham once said, "I definitely want Brooklyn to be christened. I don't know into what religion yet."
Yes, footballers shouldn't be our role models, but you know, we definitely don't want corruption to get into the game of football. I mean, that would just ruin everything for everyone, right?
Yeah.
It does seem like, you know, it sounds like he's a good person. He wants to do good. Is this kind of like a Dennis Rodman going to North Korea situation where like he thinks he's going to like, you know, make good with the leaders and make some change, and really what he's going to do is
like, that what Dennis Rodman actually thought?
I don't know.
I am going to make North Korea into like a paradise.
Why wouldn't he think that? These huge sports stars, they're like gods. They can do this thing everywhere they go. It's, you know, the red carpet is rolled out. Mm. People are blown away to meet them. Why wouldn't he believe that if he goes to North Korea, he'd have power?
I honestly believe that. I don't know much about Dennis Rodman, but I reckon he probably did think that more than David Beckham thinks that he's going to affect social change in Qatar.
Let's see what the audience has to say. Jose Martin, you agree David Beckham should not take money to promote Qatar. Why not?
Well, I was once in Shanghai, and I thought I saw a familiar face, and it was David Beckham selling suppositories. This was like an imposter. So I don't think he knew he was selling suppositories.
Sorry. Did you say something about suppositories in
yes.
that?
Yes. Right.
He was selling suppositories. I don't know that he knew that he was selling suppositories. I think he shows up to like a shoot, and they're like, "This is for Qatar," and he's like, "Right, yeah, Qatar, yeah." And then they're like, "But they violate human rights," and they're like, and he's like, "Are you sure?"
I'm not convinced that when someone, who I don't know who it was in your scenario, who said, "But they violate human rights." But I'm not sure David did say, "Are you sure?" I think he went, "Oh, okay."
Let me ask you this, Jose. Have you ever yourself done something for money that you regret?
I pay taxes and then like, and then I became unemployed. And then the government paid me £160 per month.
I'm not sure that's doing something for money.
No.
That's you regretting...
Sorry, OnlyFans? Is that what you're looking for? OnlyFans? Sorry.
From where I'm sitting, I'd subscribe.
I'm going to get you cancelled.
But is that all right? I didn't mean to objectify you there.
There's more of it.
Okay. Fine, okay. Harry Bailey... Why do you think David Beckham shouldn't have accepted that gig?
I feel like he's more intelligent than everyone seems to have given him credit for. And I feel like he's made a bad brand decision rather than anything else.
Let me ask you this, Harry. Have you ever done something for money that you regret?
For a good 5 years, I was an accountant, and I think...
Watch out, Jose.
Yeah. The trade-off between enjoying life, well, enjoying work, and money, I think I made a bad trade-off.
What do you do now?
I work for a cryptocurrency hedge fund.
That was brilliant. Thanks so much, Harry. Time to move on from David Beckham, but let's be sympathetic to him and trust he has good intentions. What's he meant to do with his time? It's difficult for sportsmen to age, their career comes to an end, their bodies change. I can be moved to tears remembering the glory of Beckham in his heyday, doing what God intended, modelling underpants. Finally, we're going to talk about Jane Austen. Jane Austen was a novelist, born in Stephen, can you check Wikipedia before recording? Oh, sorry. Stephen, you're fired. Anyway, we're going to talk about the delightful novels of Jane Austen.
Beware! Beware! Beware!
The works of Jane Austen are harmless fare, you might think. But it was recently reported that Aberdeen University decreed they should come with trigger warnings. Obviously, students do need warnings when they're about to do a university course in English literature. They need to be warned they're about to put themselves £40,000 in debt for no discernible benefit. But 92% of our live audience in the theatre tonight believe Jane Austen should not come with a trigger warning. David Baddiel, what do you think?
I am the ambassador of the Jane Austen House. I am. It's a museum in Dorset. I am the official ambassador. I've never been there. It's true, I've never been there. For all I know, it's a shithole. There's bonnets and fans everywhere, old invites to country dances. I don't know. I was asked to be there because I'm a massive fan of Jane Austen. Because you think of her as not being able to speak, perhaps, to a very modern audience, but that's not true. There was a recent British vote about her top novel. It was very similar to the Brexit vote, because Pride and Prejudice defeated Sense and Sensibility. Thank you very much. That is just a joke, isn't it? Trigger warnings, right? As I get older, I used to like horror films, and now I can't watch horror films. I think if there's a jump scare, it might actually kill me. And so what I do, you can do this, you can find out exactly where the jump scare will be. Doing that, when I look at a horror film, I'm doing that. I am seeking out trigger warnings because I don't want to be too disturbed and upset. I can tell you a serious story that might bring the mood down a bit. Should I do that later on?
Yeah, do it later on. My personal feeling about Jane Austen novels is, you know, they're good, but she's no Richard Osman. No, I'm joking. I think the novels are wonderful, but I'm quite open to the idea of trigger warnings generally. Grayson, what do you think?
I've not read a Jane Austen novel since I was doing O-level, so my wife is more of an expert on it, so I just sort of quickly asked her whether they should be trigger warnings. And there's quite a litany of things that, for to the modern, sensitive, politically correct audience, Mr. Wickham, she says, goes off with a 15-year-old, and there's a lot of probably slave money sloshing around in some of the backgrounds of some of the people going there. There's a bit of ageism. I think the main warning for young people, though, should be this book contains whole sentences. And punctuation, you know, stuff like that.
Lancaster University has warned students of Gothic literature that the genre is known for featuring scenes of dread and haunting. Desiree, you went to Yale, I think.
I did, yeah.
Were trigger warnings a thing then?
Not in my day. They were just like, you're here, deal with it. We're going to shove all of the whitest literature down your throat so far. You'll be just crapping out fear until you're 40. I mean, those are the trigger warnings that I think that you should get on Jane Austen. Like, we all read it in high school. The trigger warnings I wanted was, warning, you are about to witness some extreme caucasity. There will be lots of women sitting around going, who's going to marry me? So I can move from one castle to another castle and do my needlepoint over there. And trigger warning for all the brown kids, other white people really think this is how the world works. And also, trigger warning for all of the women in the class. When you watch the made-for-TV movie with Jennifer Ely and Colin Firth, you will have spontaneous weird feelings about a man who could be your father, watching Colin Firth in the bathtub being like, why am I having all of these feelings? I'm 16. Like, the entire class was just like, watching this thing. Those are the trigger warnings I think are needed for Jane Austen.
Here's my serious pitch. I think for older people, we make one big squidge of all the things we're frightened of when it comes to repression of free speech. So we think cancel culture and wokery and trigger warnings are the same thing. And they're not the same thing. And trigger warnings are actually the antidote to cancel culture. So instead of saying, let's get rid of these books, let's silence these people, let's ban that comedian, they are saying, let's put something on it so you know what you're getting. And why not say, you might be a bit frightened by this. If you've had this experience, you might be upset by that. The whole problem with cancel culture, you mentioned at the beginning, David, people take one thing out of context. This show knows as well as anyone. Take one line out of context and make it mean something it doesn't. Whereas trigger warnings are all about adding context. You're joking about extreme caucasity, but the problem with Jane Austen is she doesn't mention the wars that are going on abroad. She doesn't say that it's coming from slave money. Where is the harm of saying, by the way, here's what she doesn't say. Or leaving the statue up, but putting a sign on it saying, by the way, this is what you might want to know about the guy. I think trigger warnings could be our salvation.
I think, though, some of those trigger warnings are going to get quite repetitive in American literature where it's like, might contain racism. Like every book up through the 80s might contain racism. So,
Shall I tell you my serious story?
Go on.
I'm going to tell you it. When I was 15, Mr. Fitch, who I really liked, he was a brilliant English teacher, he read out loud a poem by T.S. Eliot called Burbank with a Baedeker, Bleichstein with a Cigar. And in the middle of that, there are two lines which go, the rats are underneath the piles, the Jew is underneath the lot. And I was devastated. I was incredibly upset. And I just think now, maybe if Mr. Fitch had said, if there are any Jewish boys in here, you might be upset by this or you might not want to hear this, then I'd have been pleased.
Grayson, when you look back at your student days or your school days, do you think the problem is they were just too gentle with our feelings?
I don't know. David's story made me think about our history teacher once. I think it was like kind of like one of those odd end of term days when they thought they could be a bit more kind of free and easy. And he read us this passage, and he was the kind of head of the naval cadets, and he had a sort of naval beard like this, and he sort of stroked his beard. And he read us this passage about, I think it was James the First, and when he went hunting, they used to sort of slit the belly of the stag, and he would take his trousers off and waddle in the intestines, much to his delight. 15-year-old me going, yeah. So there is precedent for perverts like me.
A lovely story. Let's go to the audience.
I love the idea that that's what lightened the mood. That's
Well, you know.
Where is Michelle Davis? The audience have all been given things to tick, you see, whether they agree or disagree with the statements. Michelle Davis, you didn't agree or disagree with the Jane Austen topic.
I went to comprehensive school, so we didn't really read much highbrow stuff.
See, I found that one of the most heretical statements of the night. What did you read?
Oh, we read a really boring book called Zed for Zachariah, and I don't even remember what it was about, but it was rubbish.
Well, that will stand as a trigger warning for that book. Thank you very much, Michelle. We better wind it up there with a hooray for trigger warnings and Jane Austen. She's bigger than her novels. Hollywood has often turned to Jane Austen for inspiration. Pride and Prejudice is lurking behind Bridget Jones's Diary. Emma was reimagined as Clueless, and Mansfield Park was sparklingly adapted into Die Hard 2. That was our last plea of the night to keep your minds open. I genuinely think trigger warnings are good, though I have been campaigning for them to be preceded by a kind of alert so that people like me who are triggered by them are given fair warning. Of course, these alerts should probably be heralded by some kind of heads up letting people know that a trigger warning alert is imminent. That said, I can't think of anything worse than coming across a trigger warning alert heads up without being cautioned that one is on the way. And call me a snowflake, but I shudder to think what it must be like to have a trigger warning alert heads up caution sprung on you without it being flagged up well in advance. Thanks so much to my amazing guests, David Baddiel, Desiree Birch and Grayson Perry. See you next time if we're not cancelled. Good night.
Heresy is written, presented and produced by Victoria Corin-Mitchell with additional material from Dan Gaster and Charlie Skelton. The series was created by David Baddiel and it is an Avalon production for Radio 4. After the news, Alice attempts to come to terms with recent events in The Archers. Next.
Welcome, John Holmes, curator of The Skewer.
Thank you.
Describe series 12 of The Skewer in one word.
New.
In one sound.
New.
In one emotion.
What?
In one internet meme.
No, I'm not doing that.
In one flavour.
This is stupid.
In one animal.
No.
In one literary quotation, so highbrow that only Radio 4 listeners will understand.
Oh, there was a young lady from Bude who went for a swim in the nude. A man in
Time's up. When does the new series of The